The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
So, good morning. We've taken in a lot of thought already today. So we should take a deep breath, relax, give attention. And we'll begin with prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity to be with you, to be with one another. Thank you for informing our lives in such a way that we can be different. Different than the prescribed way of our nature. And different in the way that the world operates, that we have you to control us, to give us a vision of what needs to happen in our lives and in this world. So we come together knowing that you are God and we are not, and we ask for your wisdom in Christ's name. Amen. So we're going to talk about being in the world today, and this message is entitled The Charlotte Mason Distinctive. Everyone has a way of being in the world. Each of us has a way of being in the world. A way of being in relationship with mathematics. A way of being in relationship with the natural world. A way of being in relationship with history. A way of being in relationship with others. A way of being in relationship with oneself, one's emotions, one's desires, one's dreams. A way of being in relationship with God, a way of being in relationship with knowledge, a way of being in relationship with our vocation, with students, with books and things, and a way of being in relationship with ideas. The list continues. It'd be a nice, thoughtful exercise to take out a piece of paper and to reflect upon individual ways of being. Because we just have kind of taken it for granted. This is the way I am. This is the way we are. And Helen Keller had a way of being in the world. She was both blind and deaf. She described her relationship with the natural world as a young person. Quote, "During the summer, when I am in Massachusetts, I almost live in my boat. Nothing gives me greater pleasure than to take my friends out rowing when they visit me. Of course, I cannot guide the boat very well. Someone usually sits in the stern and manages the rudder while I row. Sometimes, however, I go rowing without the rudder. It is fun to try to steer by the scent of water grasses and lilies and of bushes that grow on the shore. I use oars with leather bands, which keep them in position in their oar locks. And I know by the resistance of the water when the oars are evenly poised. In the same manner, I can also tell when I am pulling against the current. I like to contend with wind and wave. What is more exhilarating than to make your staunch little boat obedient to your will and muscle, to go skimming lightly over glistening, tilting waves, and to feel the steady, imperious surge of the water?" What do you notice about Helen Keller's way of being in the natural world? It defies a power of measurement. I mean, she was in Alabama, after all. Water moccasins in those places of water. When I first read that, I'm just like, I wouldn't have put my hands in that water. But yet, she had a different way of being in the world. A way of trust, a way of courage, and a way in which she was curious, and no one would measure her according to what she could do and couldn't do based on sight and hearing. Charlotte Mason was a British educator who lived from 1842 to 1923, and she gives an account of what it was like for her to be in the world as a teacher. She called it an educational cul-de-sac. A cul-de-sac is this closed street at one end, and it's also considered a dead end, a place that leads to nowhere. She quotes, I quote her. She begins, "Some years ago, I was accustomed to hear, 'Habit is 10 natures,' delivered from the pulpit on at least one Sunday out of four. I had at that time just begun to teach, and was young and enthusiastic in my work. It was to my mind a great thing to be a teacher. It was impossible but that the teacher should leave his stamp on the children. His own was the fault if anything went wrong. If any child did badly in school or out of it, there was no degree of responsibility which youthful ardor would not equal. But all this zeal notwithstanding, the disappointing thing was that nothing extraordinary happened. The children were good on the whole because they were the children of parents who had themselves been brought up with some care. But it was plain that they behaved very much as 'twas their nature to. The faults they had, they kept. The virtues they had were exercised just as fitfully as before. The good, meek little child still told fibs. The bright, generous child was incurably idle. In lessons, it was the same thing. The dawdling child went on dawdling. The dull child became no brighter. It was very disappointing. The children, no doubt, got on a little, but each one of them had the makings in her of a noble character or a fine mind. And where was the lever to lift each of these little worlds?" The term here, nature, comprises primary appetites and desires, natural affections and emotions, and heredity. It includes temperament and physical characteristics. So we have a lot to begin with. What we have because we're created beings, and what we have because of our heritage from our families. And so for most people, we begin there and we end there, and we expect no more. And so Charlotte Mason says, the way... Back up. The way of being in the world and its multitudinous facets is derived from our nature and the experience that we have breathed in from family, schooling, church, friendships, and cultures. And we have a strong inclination to leave people as their nature is. I had that inclination as an early teacher. In my experience, what happened in the classroom was left up to the teacher in his or her way of being in the world. Some teachers were considered strict, others indulging the whims of their students. Students were cajoled through the use of incentives to motivate learning, from the promise of free time, no homework, extra recess, the use of shame to get them to do what they ought to do, using systems of demerits, or just leading them to their natures. Schools had their own social hierarchy depending on the community: jocks, the gifted and talented, thespians, or children of the most involved persons. So everybody here in my initial schools were functioning as their nature was. Teachers, parents, schools, there wasn't much thought. It was very eclectic. Everybody's kind of doing what they want. So parents would vie if there were 5 third grade classes for the third grade teacher that they wanted, and so on. And so that was in my early first 10 years of teaching. After that 10 years, I thought of this. I thought to myself, do I want to be doing this for the rest of my life? How do we educate? Is there a consistent approach with regards to a Christian philosophy and practice of education? So I began a personal pursuit. I visited about 50-plus schools, read books and articles on ways of teaching, and in my pursuit, I met a principal who gave me the 6 volumes of Charlotte Mason. He said to me, "Read these, tell me what you think." So I began to read with passion. He asked me also to outline them, and I began to do that. As I read, I began to grow, and I began to change. I was experiencing being with my students in a very different way, a way of flourishing for both the student and me, grounded on something more than our natures. I remember the day on a Monday I'd read about how Charlotte Mason talked about you as a teacher are the one in authority and you don't need to use any kinds of incentives to get them to do what they ought to do. And so I was teaching third grade at the time, and so the very next day, I took the jar of M&Ms, I brought it up front, and the trembling you could see in the students, oh, are we going to have M&Ms today? And, you know, they all began to sit up a little straighter, and I said, I just want to share something with you. I said, you see this jar? Yes, they saw the jar. And I said, I've been using these candies to manipulate you to do what you ought to do. And they just sat there and looked at me. And I said, and that was wrong. And I'm not going to do that anymore. So I'm not going to use candies to get you to do what you ought to do. We're just going to be doing it because this is what we should do. And one little boy raised his hand and said, does that mean we're not going to have candy anymore? And I said, you got it. He goes, oh. But it was amazing that in just a very short time, no one ever even missed the candy. Nobody asked about it because now they were delighting in learning and doing the things as they ought to do. So my year began like that. Every day I had the freedom to come back and say, oh, let's do this. We're going to do this. At the school I was presently at, they had a fun Friday, which meant that in the elementary school, if children had all the marbles or whatever they put in jars, that they could have something special to do on Friday afternoon. And when I took the job, I said to the principal, do I have to have fun Friday? And he said, well, what will you do? I said, we'll just have some more learning. He said, well, they usually have pizza and a movie. I said, well, they get that probably at home. Could we not do something else? And he said, sure, if you want to. So one of the students wanted to ask me, he said, why is it that we never have fun Friday? I said, well, we have fun Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And he said, oh. So it was a different way of being in the classroom, and that's what I was teaching them. So what we did is we went out as I was reading about nature study, and we began to pursue nature. We put up bird feeders. We began to identify the plants around us. We took little nature walks. We played with acorns. We played in the woods. And it was an enjoyable time for both teacher and students. Charlotte Mason said, the child must not be left to his human nature. And I would argue neither should the adult be left to his human nature. This is precisely what half the parents in the world and 3/4 of the teachers are content to do. And what is the consequence? That the world is making advances, but the progress is, for the most part, amongst the few whose parents have taken their education seriously in hand, while the rest, who have been allowed to stay where they were, be no more or no better than nature made them, act as a heavy drag. For indeed, the fact is that they do not stay where they were. It is unchangeably true that the child who is not being constantly raised to a higher and higher platform will sink to a lower and lower platform. Wherefore, it is as much the parent's duty to educate his child into moral strength and purpose and intellectual activity as it is to feed him and clothe him, and that in spite of his nature, it must be so. Is it not often true when we look at students in school, and if we stay out of school long enough to see the children graduate, we see the students who struggled with maybe inattention or doing the work that they should, and the students who worked well and enjoyed being with everyone at the school, they virtually stay at the same place unless we use a lever to lift them. And they do not stay the same. And so how can we raise them up? So Charlotte Mason had an answer. After all, when we think about a job description of a teacher in mathematics or in reading, a cycle of downloading information for instruction, testing, and grading to determine the student's capacity and then group them according to their ability. And what about a teacher of science or literature who... students who do well in these areas do it because they are predisposed to like science or literature, or they care about the grade. Are we educating them according to their nature? How can this be? So we have ability grouping in mathematics and reading. We have reading groups. The research 25 years ago when I did it showed that reading groups don't work, that students who are all reading at the same level hardly ever raise the level? How would you like to take a foreign language and be grouped according to ability? That you were with people who stammered and stuttered in your group, and yet the ones who could speak it somewhat fluently and had good pronunciation were all together. How could I learn? The only voice I would hear would be the teacher's or a recorder. And so it makes sense that the strong people bring up the weak. We do that in sports. If you have a JV team and a varsity team, you love for the JV runners to run with the varsity. And yet when we have education, we feel like to separate them is the only course that we can offer. In our schools, we have seen children who have been weak in areas grow in ways that their parents had no idea that they could grow in ways that even some teachers thought they couldn't grow. And yet it's been exciting to see that when we put students together and continue the rigor, continue the practice, that the students do grow. But when they're in weaker groups, they act in weak ways. If we believe in a growth mindset, which many authors espouse, such as Charlotte Mason, Robert Rosenthal, Barbara Arrowsmith Young, Norman Dorridge, Malcolm Gladwell, Daniel Pink, and Carol Dweck, we must change our ways of thinking about the schooling and our ways of education. I mean, we have a plethora of text today that talks about a growth mindset. It's exciting to read. We love the stories. Now we need to practice these principles. Carol Dweck is the woman out of Stanford who has worked with different groups of students, and she's has a book called Mindset. She talks about students with fixed mindsets, students with growth mindsets. And so she begins to help them change their ways of thinking about themselves. And she has large samples, 10,000 students that she has tested to see the difference. And when students have a growth mindset, they soar. When they have a fixed mindset, they stay the same or move to a lower place. Two ways of understanding education. There's the age-old method of writing upon students like a blank slate or a blank tablet on the children's hearts and minds. We instruct them, they prepare, they study, they're tested, they're graded, and that takes on an identity of its own. I worked at a school that had the requirement for the elementary was the students had to have 27 pages in their packet of the work that they had accomplished that week. Well, what I became was a workshop queen. I began a worksheet queen. I began to create these worksheets that I thought would be fun to do. I mean, we wanted more grades in history because I want to give them an advantage to doing more work so they would get a better grade. And I remember hating Sundays, the Sabbath, because I literally had a pile from here to the floor that I had to put together, arrange, and order, and record of the students' work that week. I was very excited about writing the worksheets, not so excited about grading them. And so when I came upon Charlotte Mason's philosophy, I just thought, wow, what a life without worksheets. I had my Sabbath back. And when you think about that age-old method, I was responsible to make sure they knew everything. And I actually told them the little bits of knowledge that they would have to know. Review, pre-test, review sheet, test, and then we would grade it, take the last grade off, all these ways of looking at these children. And then the other way is education as bringing persons to maturity. What does it mean to be a mature 8-year-old? What does it mean to be a mature 12-year-old, a 16-year-old? What does it mean to be a mature person in this world? Unfortunately, in the 21st century, we have low degrees of maturity, not just in children, but in adults. So there aren't very many good examples of maturity. The good news is that the maturity that they see at the Christian school are good examples, and so it could cause and envision them to be those kinds of persons. But we're living in a culture in which the normative standards have changed. And I grew up in a culture where every adult around me was acting in a mature way. The neighbors were mature, the relatives were mature, and my parents were mature. Neighbors talked to us about ideas. They talked to us about knowledge. They cared about where we were going, who we were talking to. And that wasn't that long ago. But we live in a different kind of world, a world that's isolated and allows the whole world to come into our space and into our place. And it's, for the most part, a very immature world. So children learn to grow. Why must the child learn? I love the season of spring. There's little surprises that pop up every day. Look at the flowers. Look at the buds. Look at the little rabbits come out. Taking a walk around my neighborhood, it's beautiful just to see the outbursts of green, all the shades of green. We never expect these plants not to grow. They were intended to grow. And so children, too. So adults, too. Children learn to grow in all kinds of ways. And those little surprises ought to be popping up in your classrooms, in your homes, in your schools. Why do we eat? It is not in order that the body may live and grow and be able to fulfill its functions. Precisely so must the mind be sustained and developed by means of the food convenient for it. Just as the limbs grow strong with exercise, so does intellectual effort with a given power of the mind make that power effective. People are apt to overlook the fact that mind must have its nourishment. We learn that we may know, not that we may grow. Hence the parrot-like saying of lessons, the cramming of ill-digested facts for examination, all the ways of taking in knowledge which the mind does not assimilate. All those worksheets, that wasn't growing in knowledge. It was working on worksheets. Maybe they gained a little bit here, they gained a little bit there, but they weren't growing. They weren't growing in how to finish the worksheet fast so they could go ahead and do the other thing. And so what does it look like to have a relationship with knowledge where children grow? Real books, real things. This knowledge is neither sacred or is no longer sacred or, and secular, great and trivial, practical and theoretical. All knowledge dealt out to us in such portions as we are ready for it is sacred. Knowledge is perhaps a beautiful whole, a great unity, embracing God and man in the universe, but having many parts which are not comparable with one another in the sense of less or more, because all are necessary. Each has its functions. Next, we perceive that knowledge and mind of man are to each other as the air and lungs. The mind lives by means of knowledge, stagnates, faints, perishes, deprived of this necessary atmosphere. Think about a time when you were powerless. I have a friend who has a daughter, and her daughter is in sixth grade at the time. And she noticed an attitude with her daughter. She was coming and going in the home as usual, but she noticed a kind of seclusion. She was moving to her room a little bit more. She seemed to have an attitude of not wanting to be interrupted. So she called her daughter out, and she said, "So what have you been reading?" And she said, "Why?" And she says, "Well, I just want to know, what have you been reading?" And she said, "Well, some books." And she said, "Well, what kind of books?" "Oh, some books I got at school." "From whom?" "Someone gave them to me." "Who?" So, you know, as parents and as teachers, you have this long questions and brief answers. And so finally she got to the idea that the daughter was reading some of just trivial books that most teens read if they're in other kinds of schools. And now her daughter had captured her interest. Who's popular? Who's going with who? Etc. And she said, "Well, I've noticed something about you. Your attitude's changed at home. You're unwilling to do this, and you're kind of crabby." And she said, and the mom said, "I think it's because of what you're reading. And so may I have those books?" She said her daughter was resistant to give them to her, and she returned them back to the mother of the child who had given them to her. And she said, "You know, we have a rule in our house that you read the classics, and there's a reason for that." You see, she was fainting, she was perishing, but sometimes she didn't even know it herself because she had an interest to see what was going to happen next. But it didn't feed her in the ways that she needed to be fed. You know, we might read a book that's a page-turner and, as my husband calls it, brain candy. But we need books that really nourish us, nourish our minds, nourish our hearts. And the ideas of moral character and the ideas of God, the ideas of this great inheritance before us need to be present in those kinds of books. Charlotte Mason facilitated a new way of being in the world. She saw these children before her as persons who exceeded the power of measurement. Many students come into our school and we have information about them. I remember the kindergarten parent who said to me, "I have a son who has an IQ of 151. What are you going to do for him?" I said, "Well, what I'm going to do for him is what I'm going to do for all the other kindergartners. I'm going to provide a great education, and this is how I'm going to do it." And I shared that with her. And she said, "Okay, I'm in." And, you know, it was interesting because that parent never asked again for me to verify what we were doing, to make sure her child was learning. She was excited because she had thought that maybe his IQ needed some different kinds of attention. And I said, "We have a rich curriculum. There's many things to be interested in it. And he will grow and he will learn." Other parents come in. I remember a father coming in, and as I was giving him the tour of the school, he was telling me about his first grade son, and he said to me, "Is my son going to have science when everybody else does, even if he doesn't want to?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "He's not going to like that." I said, "He'll learn." He goes, "Oh, okay." He says, "It seems like everything around here is pretty deliberate, isn't it?" I said, "Yes, it is." And so here is a young boy. Can you imagine being in first grade and deciding whether or not you want to participate in the classes that are before you? In some schools, they make those choices. And so Charlotte Mason says we have a problem before the educator. The problem before the educator is to give the child control over his own nature, to enable him to hold himself in hand as much in regard to the traits that we call good and as those to which we call evil. See, it's not up to us to control the child. It's not us to be the power in the child's life. It is our goal to give the child control over his nature so that he could call good good and evil evil. In order to maintain this position of seeing every student as a person, Charlotte Mason said, there are prohibitions for us. And this is one of the distinctives of Charlotte Mason, is that there are things you can do and there are things that you can't do. Now, I had never had that experience before because really all avenues were open to me as a classroom teacher, and not just to me, but to all my colleagues as well. So all kinds of things happened in our schools. And so some of the prohibitions that she gives us is she says, these children are persons and we do not want to play too much on any natural desire. Children have a natural desire to please. All human beings do. Children want to please. But if we begin to have a relationship with a child that's based on them trying to please us, then they will become like a kind of parasite looking for the next host. And so Charlotte Mason said the host could come in the way of a fellow companion, it could come in the way of a spouse, and it could be present in the way of a teacher. And so I would never think of wanting to create a parasite as a human being, but I did create those parasites because I had students who wanted to seek my pleasure. What would you like me to do now? I would like you to obey. I would like you to sit up straight. I would like you to work well. I would like you to do this. And it was all dependent with the word I. Now, there's nothing wrong with having high standards for students in classes. We have standards and they're high. But it's not because of me. It's because this is what's good for you. So she says there's three tools before the educator. The first one is the relational and emotional atmosphere. What is breathed in from persons and things when students come into your space, your classroom, your school? What's on the walls? What does the furniture look like? What are the relationships like? Teacher with students, students with students. We sometimes have parents in our schools who ask us not to have their child sit next to another student because that student irritates them. And so we tell our parents that that's precisely the student that the child needs to sit next to, because he needs to learn how to deal with irritation, and maybe he can help support the child in not being so irritating. And so we'll help him grow that way. But we cannot accommodate all these likes and dislikes. So when you go into our schools, you're not going to see things hanging from the ceiling. You're not going to see all the primary colors in the kindergarten class. What you're going to see is real wood, furniture. You're going to see bookshelves. It's going to look like a little den or a study. And they're going to be smaller desks for the younger children. And there's beautiful places and spaces to be and spaces to look at. Inspirational quotes, a picture that they're studying in picture study. They're going to have a little nature table. And things don't have to change every 3 months. I remember when I was teaching in the traditional way, I had 6-foot bulletin boards, 3 of them in my classroom. They had to be changed every 3 months. And the school that I was working at had a rule, nothing from the teacher's store. Everything needed to be cut out by hand. Well, I was glad I was single because that took a lot of time. It took a lot of time to do all of that work with 3 bulletin boards being changed every 3 months. Our classrooms virtually remain the same. Yes, we take down a picture. It's kind of like a home. We're not redecorating all the time. It's easier for the teacher. We don't have metal desks or metal cabinets in our rooms. They're places of beauty, places people like to be. There's spaces for children to sit on the floor on a nice rug so they can sit around and hear a story. There's places for them to go outside and sit at a table. There's places of being that are very different than just the ordinary school. It's also interesting when I began to become a principal and I was practicing this philosophy, I wrote in the teacher's handbook, bulletin boards need to express what we're learning in the classroom. No bulletin boards, all about me. When I was working at a previous school, we had to have those bulletin boards. They took up probably the first 2 to 3 months of the school year where it was all about me. We'd get to see where so-and-so went on vacation, who their puppy was, all the kinds of things that they did. And I just thought it's not really in the best interest because now it's a kind of comparative thing. Look what I look like. Look where I went. Look what I have. And all of these kinds of things. And so that there's no harm intentionally done, but yet it was much comparison. Then when we started Ambleside, I had a parent of the high school student, and she said, Mary Ellen, don't you think it'd be a great idea if we got a lot of pictures of the students, and they just had their own bulletin board in the classroom, and they could put pictures up randomly, and they could just look at it. I think that would be fun. They would feel like ownership of this room. And I said, well, I really don't think that would really help the growth in the classroom. It would hinder it. Oh, there's a party you went to. 3 people were invited, but 3 people weren't invited. I don't want to bring that into my classroom. I don't want to have to deal with the effects of pictures. And, this was before Facebook, but now that we have Facebook, it all goes on there. But I don't want my classroom to be a place where we're promoting relationships in a certain way, and they're private. When things happen outside of school, yes, I'm sometimes aware of them, but I'm concerned about the things that happen in the schoolroom, and I want to be able to relate with the students in that way. I can't control parties, although we do have it in our handbooks. If you're going to have a party, everybody in the class needs to be invited. You can have a gender-specific party, but all the girls need to be invited, or all the boys. You cannot leave students out. If you have a party that's coming from school and it's just 1 or 2 persons because you don't want to have a big party, the children cannot leave from school to go to the party with the presents in hand and the 2 students going off into the van. Bye, y'all. I'm going to the party now, because that upsets relationships. So we've had to instruct our parents in these kinds of things because it hurts relationships in the classroom. And then students feel rejected or not participating because they are in some way rejected. So in those kinds of ways, we've created some support in those relationships. Thinking about active participation for all. What is it like when students come into your classroom? Is it a welcoming atmosphere? Do you go bright-faced? Are you attuned with them? Do you look eye to eye? Do you get down on their level? I remember teaching in sometimes substituting in classes where I was teaching first grade. I hardly saw their eyes. So I would bring a little chair to the front of the room, and I would sit on the chair, and this way I could see all their eyes. It's an important thing. You don't want to have the children always looking up at you or looking down. And so it's an important thing to look eye to eye, to connect in those ways, to have attunement. Thinking about students. Students, there are some students that are easy to be with. And the beauty of being a teacher is that you have all these relationships every year. And there are some students who are acting contrary ways at times. And in their contrary ways, sometimes they're difficult to relate with. But those are places where you can grow and where students can grow. So we work all these things out. They also participate in worthy work. What would happen if work in school was a natural response to knowing, not reducible to a letter or a number or praise or approval? What if students wrote, conversed, thought, painted, computed, listened, illustrated, or diagrammed as a response to the learning that occurred rather than as a task to complete? What if they knew that working well was a normal human response to work? And when they faced challenge or misunderstanding, personal weaknesses or ignorance, a teacher or a parent came alongside to support this weakness and inform this ignorance. Students breathing in this atmosphere develop a growth-oriented mindset. They don't begin to see themselves as, I'm the person who can do this but can't do this. So every student is involved in that worthy work. We teach our students to draw. We teach our students to compute. We teach our students to act. And this broad atmosphere of education allows students to see them as a person who is thriving and growing. So the first is just the atmosphere of environment. What is it breathed in your school? What is it breathed in your classroom? Is someone in your class breathing in something different than other students? Give attention to that. And then the other is instruction and habits. Charlotte Mason says habit is 10 natures. Think about all that we've been given at birth. And she says habit is 10 times that strength. And so we've had a lot in our reading in this past probably 5 to 10 years about habits. Everybody's talking about habits. And she says, why children are incapable of steady effort. She says, if it were poor training that should keep the child dependent upon personal influence, what happens after they leave your class? It is the business of education to find some way of supplementing the weakness of the will. I used to have parents say to me, oh, I wish you'd teach the next grade and the next and the next. And I used to think it was because they thought I was a good teacher. And I think they probably thought that. But really, now that I know I've understood this, is that I had a personal influence. Under my watch, you will do what you ought to do. And so it was my personality I was using more than principles. And so as I understood these ideas of Charlotte Mason, I began to see about habit training. Habit training wasn't a habit of the week. It wasn't a habit of the month. It wasn't specific habits for first grade or specific habits for second grade or specific habits for 18-year-olds. We were always training in habit. So how do you know which ones to begin with? Well, begin with attention. It's the most important. Attention needs to be directed. It needs to be sustained, and it needs to be redirected. We could speak literally 8 hours on habit training. So we are only giving you a part of it. She speaks about habit training in her first book, 90 pages, and she has a lot to say about it. So these habits are based on principles. They're breathed in. When I started the school in Fredericksburg, Texas, we didn't have any alarm system of bells or anything like that. None of our schools do. And so how do they know when to start? they start when they hear the piano, because that means we're all going to assemble to sing our song, to have our prayer. And so children, when the piano begins to play, all of a sudden you see people coming from all places, outside, inside, and they're coming quietly into the room, standing in their place. They have the habit of awareness. How do you know lunch is over? The whole school eats lunch at one time. It's not in the lunchroom. They all sit at tables with their teachers. The teachers are present with their class every day at lunch. They have discussions. Some teachers go the extra mile. They have a tablecloth there. They have a candle. One of the third grade classes that was attending the native gardens said it was sad that there was no beauty on the table during lunch. So they took it upon themselves to create little pots with beauty on them and plant different things so that everybody could have something beautiful to look at, initiating that idea. So how do you know when lunch is over? The teacher just stands up. The students are playing. They look. You wait for about 2 or 3 minutes. Students come, drop the balls, put them away, and they get in line. So that kind of awareness that we are going to the next place. So those are the habits that are breathed in. It's not so easy with everything. So there are other habits that need some more deliberate attention. One of the things that we work with every class every year is how to approach work. We believe in set time for set work. And so work isn't something to abhor to get through so we can do the next thing. In fact, when I have a degree in education, and when I was in taking some of the education classes, one of the teachers or professors asked us to maybe think of some things they can do when their work was finished. And some of these teachers that I was in school with thought, well, we could think of these elaborate systems. Well, I wasn't into any of these elaborate systems, so I never really thought of that. But there was always, we need to give them something to do, so I just had books. But in our schools, when you're finished with your work, you just have to work on some more work. There's not a book. You can't just take your book from home and start reading. Why? Because then the idea is, let's get finished this so I can now read my own book. So what we have is we have ongoing work, things that we're always working on. It could be memory work. It could be finishing up our nature painting. It could be labeling our nature painting. It could be finishing a narration. It could be working in our copy book in some way. And so the teacher just puts initials on boards where students haven't finished things, and then they look up if they're finished with their math. Oh, do I have time to get out my paints? No, you only have about 5 minutes. Okay, then I'll finish this. And so then they make those choices. But we're teaching them how to work well. So when parents and visitors come to the school to see the students work, they are often kind of quiet at first when they look at it, because they can't believe a child has accomplished that work. Just like when you look at these paintings here, I mean, we all have a sense of awe. I mean, look at the depth in which those young persons painted and drew and the skill that is before us and the beauty there. Well, it's the same way. That's taught. Now, some people would say, well, it's their nature. Their father's an artist. That means they breathed in that kind of order in their home. But they had to work hard of it. When people say they're a natural, it means like they, you know, Beethoven got up one morning and started playing the piano. Not so. He practiced a lot. He practiced hours. And so the same with children. We need to get them to practice. We try to redeem those words. It's time to practice our math. It's time to practice our spelling. It's time to practice our memory work. Practice is used in sports and music and never in school. So we've redeemed that word in our school so children know this is our practice. And so they see it as something that's important and helpful for them in the long run. Students answer open-ended questions. They tell about the digestive system. In our eighth grade class, students actually can draw a diagram of the human body with all of its muscles and label it from memory. They never take it home to memorize. They have just memorized it in class. not during these 5 or 10 minute sessions, but during a time when the whole class gets together and they begin with a certain part of the body and they begin to memorize those muscles. And then the student comes up the next day and the student begins and says, let's say our muscles, da, 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 da. Oh, let's add 3 more, da, da, da. And so in a short time, they're able to memorize a lot. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, the Courtship of Miles Standish, muscles, memory verses, all kinds of things. I remember hearing a recitation in chapel with one of our classes, and it was the kindergarten class, and they memorized 18 verses. And I was so excited because often persons would think, oh, it's kindergarten. You know, 1 or 2 verses is enough. No, they can memorize a lot. It's just a little by little, adding this, adding a little bit more. And so those are the kinds of things that students are taught in their response to work. They don't know it's hard. They don't know that they shouldn't be doing that, that this is something different for a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old or a 12-year-old. This is just the way it is here. And so they are a part of that. We begin to organize our ways of relating in the classroom in ways that are life-giving. Okay, at times we have those students in our classroom who, when you begin a class, you have a student whose head is on his desk and he says to you in a beckoning voice, I'm so tired. I just can hardly make it today. And Charlotte Mason has this little phrase in one of her books. She says, we must teach children what it means to be a human being. So then the teacher just says, I know, I'm tired too, but you'll never know it because I'll never talk about it. Because you see, we have feelings that come and go throughout the day. And some of you might feel delight with learning. Others of you are like, oh no, science. But guess what? We don't have to express it because then we contaminate the atmosphere. I mean, have you ever taught before? I mean, in the old system, I was teaching middle school, and I remember, large class, the bell rang, the students were sitting down. They hadn't seen these other students throughout the day yet, so they wanted to greet them. They wanted to say hi. And so they began talking, and, you know, as a teacher, quiet down, we need to begin class, et cetera. And so there were all those kinds of moans and groans, and you just kind of ignored them, got a little stricter, spoken a louder voice. And yet here we need to inform their ignorance. It's not polite to talk about how you feel in a negative way or even in a positive way. If you say, yay, math! And then the other students like thinking, oh, I don't really like math that much. Is something wrong with me? No, nothing is necessary. You don't have to say anything. It's time for math. Get out your books. Great. We don't have these exclamations, positive or negative, throughout the day. We're not saying that no one could ever be positive or give an exclamation or cry when they're hurt. No, we're not going to that extreme. But it's not needed in everyday life. So often today, we ask children too many times how they feel about things, and it's not helpful for them. So we have chores. We don't have janitorial services in our schools. The children do the chores. And so one day I was closing out the school, it was after 5, and one of the teachers was still there. And I looked at the assembly room floor, and the person who was to mop it either didn't mop it or didn't mop it well. And so I began to bring out the mop bucket and the mop. And the teacher said, Mary Ellen? I said, yes. He said, are you going to mop that floor? And I said, yes, it's not very clean. He said, you will be mopping that floor every day. I'm the principal. He's the teacher. And I just loved him for saying this to me. And he said, call that parent and make the void come back. I said, you're right. That's what I should do. So I called the parent. I said, your son didn't finish his chore. He needs to come back and mop the floor. She says, he will be there. He rode his bicycle. He came. He mopped the floor, didn't say much. I greeted him. And I said, come get me in my office when you're finished. And he said, I'm finished. I said, a job well done. Have a nice evening. And he went. But I never asked him to mop the floor again because he always did it the first time. There was a consequence for that. You didn't do it right. You had to come back and do it. It made him unhappy for a moment, a few moments. But yet he knew that he would do what he was supposed to do. When children, we want to have a habit of speaking wisely with one another. Sometimes we say curt things. It's a fast-track response. Students say things, they respond in a quick way. And so we're saying, okay, let's rehearse that. Let's try that again. And so they say, oh, yeah, I shouldn't have said that. Da-da-da-da. And then they come back with the appropriate response. If a student comes in one class, was coming in from outside, sweating, tired, can we get a drink, can we do this, all this kind of clamor. Okay, let's go back outside. Let's go in and come back in the correct way. Too much talk of, you're not doing what you're supposed to. You're supposed to be quiet. Don't ask for a drink. We've already had drinks. All of that kind of thing, it's clamorous to the child. Their frontal lobes are shutting down. They're becoming more crabby. So just have them come back and do it again. And trust us, we give them drinks. You know, I said to the student, will you get a drink when we come in? Is that what our natural tendency is? Yes, it is. Trust. Okay, trust us. You'll get your drink. So we have three tools. We have the atmosphere of environment. We have the training and habits. And we have the presentation of living ideas. Just think for a moment. It's only a little bit before 11, and you've had some great ideas. You've had ideas from St. Patrick, from Martin Luther, from ideas about science fiction, ideas about personhood. And it's not even 11 o'clock. You're full. You're stuffed. And your children should be, too. The child is furnished with desire for knowledge and the power to apprehend this. Now, some people don't believe the children have the power to apprehend this because we have so much inattention. And we're not here to talk about attention, but Charlotte Mason talks about it 90 times in her 6 volumes. And so she has a lot to say about attention. Attention is achieved early on before school starts. That's what those beginning years are for, is to be with the mother where the mother is training them in attention. So we're equipped as creatures to have a desire for knowledge and the tools to apprehend that knowledge. We have this inheritance that's before us. And so often we devalue the intelligence of children. Sometimes I hear adults talking about children, sometimes their children. They have remarks about intelligence, firstborn, bright or dull. These children learn differently. And then they compensate it with, well, he's good at soccer, or he's an artist, or he's this, or he's that. And so these learning differences are talked about in ways which they try to accommodate for a lack. The child who knows that he's good at soccer, but the mother who defines him not being good at mathematics, is not a happy child. The child wants to be good at mathematics, too. And so we devalue the intelligence, give everybody a broad curriculum, see what they know. Some children need more practice. Some children need more support. Give it to them. Have their parents give it to them. Show them how. Sometimes we mediate too much. We direct. We expect. We suggest. Everything is dependent upon us. Have your classroom work in such a way where things just happen as they should. It's time for chores. People go about. You don't have to talk about what they need to do. That's already been talked about. Then you provide a generous curriculum. You're having lots of food for the mind. Our students participate in 15 to 17 different subjects a week. So when you're thinking about Charlotte Mason's philosophy of education, it is a practice of education that is a way of being in the world. As a person continues learning and growing, we live in a world in which we are more informed than ever about how the mind works. We know that the brain is online when there is attunement in relationships, when questions are open-ended, when rigor is present. And when the frontal lobes are darkened because of a perceived threat, they can come online again with a bigger brain comes along when a bigger brain comes alongside and supports and exemplifies how to be in this world when there are threatening circumstances. Charlotte Mason is not just a selection of good practices from varied systems of philosophy. It is a congruent philosophy of education. She looked at the teacher. She looked at the nature of knowledge. She looked at the student. And she looked at what is true about persons, what is true about knowledge. She has a very authentic Christian philosophy of education with regards to anthropology, the persons, the teacher, the student, and epistemology, how the students learn. And so this work of transformation is not a one-time act in investigation or thought, but an ongoing inquiry into the beliefs that are expressed in your classrooms, in your schools, through the various choices regarding books, activities, methodology, resources. To begin this inquiry, the education